I'm Donald Roberge. The City of Montreal will be holding public consultations for a proposed plan to create a 24-hour nightlife district downtown, as well as neighborhoods around the city dedicated to after-hours activities. The meetings, to be held over the next 2 months, will give businesses, organizations, and the public an opportunity to provide their opinions and suggestions before the policy is finalized towards the end of the summer. Though specific neighborhoods have not yet been confirmed, the city wants to assure that the industries who would profit from the city's nightlife will be in harmony with the ever-growing number of residences found among bars, dance halls, and theater venues. The city believes that keeping certain businesses open for 24 hours has the potential to inject more than $600 million into the local economy while keeping the city culturally vibrant. McGill University has announced that it is working on a plan to reopen Moisey Hall, a theater in its arts building that was closed 2 weeks ago due to the discovery of asbestos. The 306-seat venue that was built in the 1920s is regularly used by the school's English department as well as for rentals and stage productions. Yet dust samples, which were collected from suspicious-looking debris on January 16th, led to air quality tests that came back positive for the toxic fiber. Adjoining rooms to the theater, including the basement, were also closed as a precaution, though the rest of the building remains open. Federal Immigration Minister Mark Miller announced changes to the International Student Visa Program this week. Katie Brady has more.
Three principal measures. One, a temporary two-year cap on new international.
During the Liberal cabinet retreat in Montreal this week, Minister Miller announced cuts to the International Student Visa Program, which the Trudeau government says is to help alleviate the housing crisis. For 2024, the cap is expected to result in foreign student visas being slashed by about a third. The bulk of the cuts will impact provinces like BC and Ontario, who have the highest number of international students already. For now, it seems Quebec, which has comparatively fewer foreign students, will be allowed to take in more pupils under the changes, but many are still wary of the shakeup. Vivian Albuquerque is an immigration lawyer in Montreal. She studied as an international student at Concordia University.
And for the vulnerability of the spouse in Canada, I mean, if you're coming to Canada in order to advance your career and then go back home and then your spouse needs to stay home and take care of the kids, you have to think about it twice. It's still not clear, and that's the part that it's really concerning me, because the government makes those announcements and it seems to be able to satisfy a specific part of the Canadian population and leaves international students in limbo.
The announcement has added to the immigration debate at home this week. Premier Legault has made several public remarks about needing to curb immigration due to strain on the system. Quebec Solidaire immigration critic Guillaume Cliche-Rivard told CJLO Quebec's housing crisis isn't caused by newcomers, and he wants to see meaningful analysis done to find solutions to Quebec's immigration question.
They are failing to this day to tell us who they would reduce, what category, and how they would do it. And I would request to those people that are requesting and are putting forward measures to reduce permanent and temporary immigrations to directly be more detailed and more specific and to tell us for sure, okay, well, if that's your position, can you please explain to Quebecers what's that going to mean and how many of them do you feel are too many? And what field is this international students that you're going to cut? Is it workers that are in the health system? Is it workers in the public sphere?
For the full interview with Guillaume Cliche-Rivard, find CJLO's weekly news roundup on Spotify. In Montreal for CJLO, I'm Katie Brady.
Welcome to CJLO's weekly news roundup, as just mentioned in the pack at the top of the hour. I am Cam, the program director here at CJLO, and I am joined on the phone by Katie. Katie, how's it going?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. How is the chase this week, just to check in?
The chase is chasing. I'm working on a lot of immigration stories this week, and it's the start of Black History Month. There's a lot of news coming down the pipe this week. We're in the winter swing of things.
Yeah, it's a very exciting time to it feels like it's exciting time to be reporting, but again, once once again, it seems like we're in this mode where the stories are, there's some not good things happening in the around Montreal.
Yeah, Quebec's Quebecing.
Yeah. Definitely on the note of Black History Month, actually, tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., I think the folks over at the Get Up are going to have a nice little episode. I think they went over to a play called Diggers yesterday, and I think they might have some updates about that. And I hope you tune in then.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. Is that the one at the Seagal Center?
I believe so.
Yeah. Don't diminish. Cool. We're going to have a lot of good stuff for February, for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's introduce this first little topic. So, asylum seekers, Katie.
Asylum seekers, yeah. We've been talking about asylum seekers in the news for a couple of weeks now. Starting when Francois Legault wrote a letter to the Prime Minister recently. And there's been some more announcements about this week. I spoke to a local community integration worker and another expert downtown near the other campus at Concordia. The folks at the Refugee Center, a lot of complicated stuff going in there, a national story, but also a very local story. Francois Legault had, you know, pointed to the high number of asylum seekers as causing strain on our system, and other people want to see something a little more careful planned out than just please stop sending them here.
It seems like things have been very direct and in a way that is, you know, not necessarily addressing underlying issues.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's jump into this pack on asylum seekers.
Okay.
We'll be back with you in a second.
In mid-January, Quebec Premier Francois Legault wrote to the Prime Minister. He said Quebec can't sustainably support the larger number of refugee claimants seen in recent years and suggested they be funneled to other provinces. On Wednesday, Federal Immigration Minister Mark Miller pledged $362 million to help provinces handle the influx. And Quebec is supposed to get about $100 million of that. But Miller pushed back on the idea of the government managing the flow of claimants around the country.
We have, in the past, had the luxury of playing hot potato with provinces and territories because of the low number of asylum seekers coming to the country. We don't have that perverse luxury anymore because we have these large flows and it is impacting some of the larger cities. And obviously, the provinces' real or perceived ability to absorb the populations.
Abdullah Daoud, executive director of the Refugee Center in Montreal, told CJLO that an outdated infrastructure to support refugees is the issue, and that the number of claimants is because of government policies like the closure of Roxham Road. It comes as no surprise to grassroots organizers.
And then when we ask for help or when we plead and make a call for help, unfortunately, we see, you know, the Premier Legault use this as an excuse to say, hey, you need to stop asylum seekers from coming in, when in reality, it's, you know, it's a legal structure, both provincially and federally, that's causing the stranglehold, this bottleneck.
He welcomes the announcement for more federal funding, but hopes it's sent to the right organizations and not just handed to the provinces. Manisha Iyer is the project coordinator at Bienvenue NDG, an organization that helps integrate immigrants. She says very few groups have permission and funding to properly serve asylum seekers, but Bienvenue NDG can offer them supports like francisation.
There's language classes that they were able to do that increase their opportunity, and we know that, like, of some this particular family at least, they have been able to sort of set up their own business, a catering business, and so it's definitely, we see resilient families that are ready to do it and that are able to achieve these things. But I think the most important factor there is the support that they have received from community organizations.
Daoud explained that the solutions must come from bureaucratic and systemic changes, not from trying to cap the number of newcomers.
I think for overall what's missing in the conversation is this idea of, you know, the ability to stop people from coming. That's not really how it works. It's not a program in which we can cap or restrict a certain amount. Global forced displacement is a reality. We're seeing displacement at the highest levels ever been historically for a really long, long, long time.
So that was Katie's pack on the situation going on with asylum seekers in Quebec and I guess across Canada as well, because this is sort of a federal story, correct?
It is a federal story, yeah. And it was a bit of deja vu with last week's sort of immigration announcement in Quebec. But this one, especially, you know, we're set to receive a pretty big chunk of that money because we do have a very high number of asylum seekers compared to other parts of the country. Yeah, it was interesting to see not a direct response to Legault's letter, but certainly an indirect one. And the press conference with the announcement yesterday was pretty lively too. A lot of reporters pushed back. They wanted more information. Especially there were a lot of questions about Toronto. Toronto, they did say, would probably be seeing a lot of money from that allocation as well, but no details yet. So, reporters gave Minister Miller a bit of a grilling about that. But yeah, it's interesting to see him, see the minister, the federal minister, push back a bit on the idea of just bouncing people around the country, or the idea that the Canadian government should just be able to tell people where they're going.
Yeah, and I understand there was a bit of like a commotion during the press conference.
It was question period yesterday. Parliament's back as well this week, so they had a lot of things on the go. He ran off at one point to do a vote. A lot of reporters seem not so happy about that. I heard one say, well, why schedule the press conference now? The minister did come back and take questions after that, though. But still, the questions about Toronto, about who's getting the money, what kind of organizations, if there's any other details coming, yeah, there's more to come on that, I think, from the feds.
So let's, transition from the federal conversation to the local conversation.
Yep. Manisha Iyer, the project coordinator at Bienvenue NDG, she is near to us down in West NDG. They have a lot of great services there. They help people integrate into the neighborhood. And she pointed out to me that they don't have specific funding for asylum seekers, but they do end up being able to help a lot of them. And we've got a bit more with her.
Yeah, there's just a great local way to, I guess, get used to life here in Quebec, because it's they offer like language services and so much more. And just like a good way to an organization that helps welcome people to the neighborhood. So let's check out this interview.
Yes. Exactly. Post-pandemic, I think we've seen an increase, which I think many other organizations have seen that as well. And the challenge there is, since we don't receive any funding to serve asylum seekers, we are not able to, you know, go beyond a certain limit that we have. However, there are a handful of organizations that do receive some funding, but since they're just limited in number, they are overwhelmed with the appointments and the wait times to see a counselor there or to find somebody who can help them is really long, and which is sad because they would be able to go through, you know, in a more thorough manner with them about on their different needs. But because it's a very few organizations that receive this funding, and so they are also overwhelmed because of that. So we've seen in NDG itself the food bank has been overwhelmed. We at Bienvenue NDG were also, you know, had a lot of asylum seekers. The schools, we all, because we work with the schools as well, and the schools contact us when they need to communicate with parents because they don't speak French or English. And so we see that there has been a rise in the numbers. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that there were sort of different needs for asylum seekers or refugees than other newcomers.
Well, I would say yes. Right. So I would say, like, the needs are similar, just that there are different layers, because the main thing is for an asylum seeker, it's a completely unplanned immigration process. I mean, they are forced to leave and they have come here. It is not a planned process, you know, like somebody who's coming in with to work here or to study or to as a permanent resident. That's a more planned process that they are going through. Whereas for the asylum seeker, it's completely unplanned. And so when they come here, they have to really, I mean, they don't have any financial means. They are dependent on the social assistance that they get. And that is by no means enough to sustain. So sometimes the wait period to receive their work permits is long, although, like I said before, the federal government has put in place certain strategies and policies that expedite this process. But it's still, you know, like for them, the first thing is to be able to earn money to feed the family, to find a house. And then, of course, here in Quebec, they need to learn the language. The language is a big barrier. And so the wait times for the French classes are also long. So, you know, it's I would just say that there are different layers in their process, in their integration.
Without naming anyone specifically, if you could share mm-hmm. some positive impacts or a success story from specifically an NDG that you've seen maybe.
I mean, we've had
specifically, what are the impacts of this work?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had families that came here as you know, as an asylum seeker with kids, and they were waiting to, you know, they became accepted, and they are right now permanent residents. But then they did their French classes, and so now they were working in just general job, but because of the language that they were able, the language classes that they were able to do, that increased their opportunity. And we know that, like, of some this particular family, at least, they have been able to sort of set up their own business, a catering business. And so it's definitely, we see resilient families that are ready to do it and that are able to achieve these things. But I think the most important factor there is the support that they have received from community organizations. And I am, of course, biased because I'm a resident of NDG, but I feel NDG is a really welcoming place for newcomers. You know, we find different cultural communities here. It's really diverse in that aspect. And the team that we have, the team of integration counselors that we have, reflect the different communities that are present in NDG as well. So.
Dive into the ultimate comic haven at Crossover Comics. Unleash your inner geek with the best selection of graphic novels, manga, games like Pokemon and Magic, in-store events, merch, and more. Our knowledgeable and friendly staff have got your back with awesome recommendations for your next read. Score big with a free account. Enjoy comic subscriptions and membership discounts. Be in on the action at 3560 Notre Dame West in St. Henry, right near Metro Lionel Brew. Crossover Comics, sharing your passions since 2012.
If you enjoy genres like slowcore, post-hardcore, noise rock, math rock, shoegaze, or anything like that, tune into Past Tense 9 p.m. Thursdays on CJLO. It also airs 9 p.m. Mondays on luradio.ca and 9 p.m. Wednesdays on cfrc.ca.
It was cold. cold. I turned my computer on.
What'd you do then, brother?
I typed www.cjlo.com.
With the com there, brother.
And I tuned into some metal and some rock and some hip-hop.
What about the funk there, brother?
There was some funk and some blues and some noise that keep me company.
And some emo to keep you crying.
And so I listened well.
Listen well, brother.
And now I know I'm not gonna go to hell.
Testify, brother.
I said I listened to CJLO.com.
I want you to sing, brother.
That's right, you're listening to CJLO, and we're available at CJLO.com and at CJLO 1690 AM as well. So radio or internet, both work. Yeah, this is our weekly news roundup. Welcome back to the talking portion of the show. I'm joined in over the phone by our LJI reporter, Katie Brady.
Hello, we're back.
Yeah, so we're going to be diving even deeper into this asylum seeker story because you did a lot of interviews for this.
I did, yeah. It's been on my brain for a few weeks now, and especially following on our other immigration reporting. So we just heard from Manish Iyer, the project coordinator at BMWNDG. Again, that's a local org down our way, our neck of town, that helps integrate people into NDG. Lots of good services. They set up families with language classes, their social events. They help set up schooling and health things. We just heard a bit from her about some of the successes that she's seen, you know, about how important these community groups really are to getting people set up when they're new to Quebec. And we spoke to one last source, Abdullah Sayed at the Refugee Center. They are on St. Catherine West, a little farther downtown. They also help integrate newcomers, refugees, asylum seekers into Montreal. They offer a lot of legal services as well. And I spoke to the executive director, Abdullah Sayed. He told me a lot about these sort of, I don't know, this is a bureaucratic problem rather than just a numbers problem. He welcomed the announcement from the federal government yesterday, but with hesitation. And his take as a grassroots organization is that, you know, we could have seen this coming. This is just going to keep coming, and our system is way old to handle this.
Yeah. So should we dive into that interview right now?
Yep, let's get to it.
All right. Here it is.
Well, first, so we're an organization based in Montreal. We offer a variety of services to refugees and refugee claimants, including academic aid, orientation, mental health services, a full service legal clinic. In regards to the influx of asylum seekers, yes, there is obviously an increasing number. This is something I think not just us, but a bunch of, you know, grassroots refugee organizations have been vocalizing to the government ever since the closure of Roxham Road, that this issue is not going to go away, and that we're going to continue to see refugee claimants come in. And that's what's happened. Actually, we have more refugee claimants now since the highest number that was coming from Roxham Road that's already been surpassed. So the issue isn't so much that there's an influx. The issue is that we've known that these numbers are going to come for a while now, and we haven't updated our infrastructure and we haven't updated our systems to accommodate those numbers, because, you know, forced migration is not something you can control. When people are being forcibly displaced and showing up at your borders, that's not something that you can have an on or off switch for.
And what are the most significant challenges that immigrants and refugees and asylum seekers face when they arrive in Montreal? And how does your organization assist in overcoming these?
Sure. I mean, there's a series of the obviously challenges, but I think the first and foremost is issues of bureaucracy. Refugee claimants are expected to do a lot within a 45-day period. For example, they have to submit their basis of claim, which is their initial document of claim. Why are you coming to Canada? What is the fear of persecution that you have? This is a legal document that kind of has to be done with a lawyer. So legal aid is already kind of overwhelmed, and there's not enough lawyers to take on these cases. So a 45-day limit is already quite small. In addition to that, there's a series of online platforms that they have to use in order to submit documentation or fill out personal information. So they have to have a level of like digital literacy or knowledge in order to do this. And I know it kind of sounds a bit easy, but it's actually quite difficult. A lot of them don't have access to laptops. They can't submit using their phones. And these are very important procedures that, you know, they can't make mistakes on. So organizations like ours, you know, have to go to all these areas in which refugee claimants are staying or sheltering and bring in laptops and help them through that process. So it's just a series of bureaucracy that they have to go through that is honestly very challenging and very stressful. In addition to that, refugee claimants don't have access to the same resettlement services that refugees or typical immigrants do. So for example, all resettlement services that are government funded are actually not allowed to use government funding to service refugee claimants. So a lot of organizations can't even help them because their funding restricts them to do so. So that already limits the scope of where they can go and who they can go to. With that being said, that puts the pressure. It's not so much that there's a high number, it's that there's a high number coupled with a little bit of outdated laws and an increased amount of bureaucracy all mixed together that makes the situation a lot more difficult on community organizations like ours. And then when we ask for help or when we plead and make a call for help, unfortunately, we see, you know, the Premier Legault use this as an excuse to say, hey, you need to stop asylum seekers from coming in, when in reality, it's, you know, it's a legal structure, both provincially and federally, that's causing the stranglehold, this bottleneck among community organizations and services.
And looking forward, what changes or improvements would your organization like to see a provincial or national level to better support the integration of immigrants and refugees? And also, how would this announcement today about $360 million Minister Miller to support this, but details to come. How would the organization like to see that divvied up or used wisely?
I think it's definitely a good move forward. It's just how that money is dispersed is obviously very important. If it's dispersed directly to the provinces without oversight, or that it going directly to the community organizations that have been kind of carrying the weight, that'd be problematic. In terms of what I would like to see, other than just, you know, financial commitments, it is legal commitments. So both provincially and federally, we believe that they should be changing the policies to ensure that public funding that goes to resettlement organizations can be used to serve refugee claimants. This would help alleviate a lot of the pressures. You know, in Montreal, I can count on one hand the number of organizations that service refugee claimants. And although we have so many resettlement organizations, but there's only very small few that can actually do so because they're either privately funded or have their own kind of funding structure outside of the government. So that needs to be looked at and needs to be addressed. I think what the announcement today was a good step forward. But it also needs to ensure that you know, these funds are allocated properly, and that there's a public announcement or a public call for proposals for organizations who have already been doing the work to have a chance to obtain that funding rather than just going to the provinces.
Okay, thank you. That's all my questions. Is there anything I haven't mentioned about where we're at in this conversation this week that you'd like
I to think overall. For sure, yeah. I think for overall, what's missing in the conversation is this idea of, you know, the ability to stop people from coming. That's not really how it works. It's not a program in which we can cap or restrict a certain amount. Global forced displacement is a reality. We're seeing displacement at the highest levels ever been historically for a really long, long, long time. You can look at the UNHCR statistics for that as well. So it's not something that we can avoid. We have to kind of meet this issue head on and update our infrastructure to accommodate the demand. Because if we don't, then, you know, it's just going to be a problem that we're stuck with, and everybody all around is not going to benefit.
I was wondering if we could talk just a bit about that, because I see a lot of people saying Quebec won't be affected because we don't have that many students. But you raised a really good point about the other aspects, about the spouses and work permits. So can you tell me a bit more about that and why you think this might be a problem?
Perfect. I took you out of speakerphone, so I can hear you very clearly now. No, absolutely. So I like to call this a bunch of measures together. And most of the people are only focused on the cap of international students, which I'm going to call this temporarily not a cap, but I'm going to call it a pause of taking international students, because the de facto policy that we have right now is that international students, we need to have an authorization from the province, an attestation letter from the province, in order to come to Canada and apply for a study permit. So the effect of this cap measure is that no one can apply for a study permit unless you have this attestation from the provinces. And the provinces, they haven't been started to issue those attestations yet. Quebec is the only province that has a mechanism in order to provide attestation letters for students that are coming to Quebec. So when we are affected, it's because Quebec already has a policy in place. The deadline for the provinces, for all the provinces to catch up and be able to provide those attestation letters, it's March. So what we have is from January to March, the only students that are applying for a study permit in order to come to Canada are from Quebec. So effectively, in de facto, we have a pause in the study program, and because all individuals with a CAQ, a Quebec Acceptance Certificate, are eligible to apply for a study permit. So this is the first set of the measures. Is the cap is a reduction in the number of study permits. We still don't know how this cap is going to be implemented. Is Canada going to be having stricter policies in terms of the selection and the admission of students? Are we going to see more refusals of study permits? Are we going to see less letters of acceptances from colleges? Or is it going to be a first-time, first-served basis, where if you meet the cap, then there we go, apply for next year? So it concerns me how the implementation of this cap will be placed, especially for students coming this fall and next year. I mean, if you're coming this fall, you're already likely received a letter of acceptance if you're doing a PhD, a master's, or even a college program. So we get to see how you're going to be affected by the cap in terms of the total number of students. The procedure for Quebec remains the same, CAQ, and then you apply for a study permit. For the other provinces, you need this attestation letter. We don't know how to get it yet. In addition to the cap and the attestation letter from the student, there has been some more changes in terms of the study, the student program. One of the biggest changes that I call it the thing is the one for work permits for spouses. The announcement that the government said that indicates that the government will be restricting study permits for spouses, except for specific programs, which mostly doesn't affect Concordia students, like the bachelor's, master's, and PhD would be exempt. But if you come in here to do a college degree or a postgraduate program, then your spouse cannot work. And this has huge repercussions to the family unit, and and for the vulnerability of these files in Canada. I mean, if you're coming to Canada in order to advance your career and then go back home, and then your spouse needs to stay home and take care of the kids, you have to think about it twice. It's still not clear, and that's the part that it's really concerning me, because the government makes those announcements and it seems to be able to satisfy a specific part of the Canadian population and leaves international students in limbo. We don't know. In limbo, international students are anxious. We cannot start planning, not strategizing, because we don't know how those policies are going to be implemented. Are students in Canada exempt from some of the measures, including the spouses of work permit for spouses? Are students in Canada who are renewing their study permits exempt from some of the requirements? So all that is still, we are still in the dark. I think it indicates a lack of respect from the Canadian government in terms of international students. You make an announcement and you don't tell them how it's going to be implemented. I have several clients who are anxious, stressed. It's a big investment to come to Canada. I myself, I was an international student ages ago, and I could not imagine, and I cannot imagine how difficult and how hard it must be for international students just seeing those policies be implemented live and not have further instructions and being in the dark and not being able to plan your life and your future.
Right. It really does seem like it's been a couple of months sort of leading up to this, but it's a lot of... it sounds nice and tidy and kind of just throwing stuff out there a little bit. There's been a back and forth in the media of, I mean, we're going to do this, we're looking at caps, they might come, other people saying, no, don't do that, you know.
Exactly, yeah. And what it seems that international students are this scapegoat, yeah, of the housing crisis or every single houses that we have in Canada, all the crisis that we have here. And the reality is that 2 years ago, Canada was facilitating the entrance of international students. Canada was going around, going abroad and saying, we want you, come to Canada. And then we'll stay here once you settle, once you make plans, once you give up so much. That Canada is like, oh no, bye, you're disposable, you're causing too much trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly in the pandemic, we made a lot of big moves. I did some reporting on international nurses during COVID, and with what you're saying, I'm just thinking of them, and they were already, you know, working,
exactly,
trying to learn French. If they, most of them are from very far away, not close. I can see how that would be the uncertainty.
The uncertainty is tremendously hard for individuals that are in Canada on a temporary basis. Students, they have a deadline to leave Canada. And being in Canada is an investment in itself, not only for the students, but the whole family. So this uncertainty creates so much anxiety, arbitrariness in terms of their stay. And the ultimately effect of it is that international, and that Canada is not going to be an attractive country for international students. I tell my students and my clients and my staff that the lack of predictability, it affects the rule of law. It affects the stability of a country. So if Canada starts having those policies that it's one day welcoming, another day not, without having long-term planning, and without taking into consideration the life situation and the planning of international students, then ultimately Canada is not going to be seen as an attractive place for international students.
And I imagine especially Quebec compared to other provinces, because we have, you know, a whole other system to deal with and we tend to do things our own way here. It'll be interesting to see how each province ends up, how they're affected long term.
Exactly.
Or if they'll just walk this back in a couple of weeks because people were mad.
Yeah, and it's going to be students in Quebec. They have they're my superheroes, because you hear your Concordia McGill or even a Francophone university, you're learning two languages. You hear you studying in English, but you have to learn French if you want to stay, or you have already planned to get a job outside Quebec. You deal with a lot of policy changes. So it's very difficult, and a blow like that in terms of your temporary status, it really affects in terms of the planning. What I understand that there are some institutions, there are some educational institutions that we call designated learning institutions that the government itself has given the approval to have international students. We understand that there are some places that has been taking advantage of international students. I have seen in my practice international students that come to Canada, they're going to a college, they're going to some educational institutions that the education level, the quality of the teaching is not the best.
The puppy mill comments from Minister Miller.
Exactly. There are some. But like everything in life and everything, every single policy, there are some bad apples. Mm-hmm. And the government needs to be able to create a long-term sustainable plan that we're able to filter out those bad apples and take out those not encourage those international students that have been here, not studying, just in Canada, take into consideration their personal perspective, the individuals that are here because they had an accident and they cannot study or they had a mental breakdown. Those are all exemptions we have to take into consideration. But there are some students that have been taking advantage of the system. But that's not the majority of the students. That's by far a minority of the students, and students themselves as a whole, as a community, they are being accused of just taking advantage of Canada or the immigration system. We forget that most Canadians, permanent residents and citizens in the last 10 years, that they were students in Canada. We forget that if you go to fast food or like a quick bite across the street, international students are serving you. Even most of the startups are made by, have been created and founded by immigrants in Canada. And immigrants in Canada, they have a high, they were students, they have a much higher salary than Canadians born in Canada. So we have to start focus on those contributions of international students and not to just put a blanket or a cap or a ban for international students. International students are the venue, the blood of Canada. This cap for me is a political measure. It's a big, you know, how sustainable and how good it is in the long term.
I really appreciate you breaking it down for me as well, the more legal aspects. You answered all my questions, and I really thank you for this.
You too. Okay. Have a good week. Bye-bye. Too. Bye.
Yeah, so that was an interview with an immigration lawyer that you just heard. Correct, Katie?
Yes, sorry about that. that was Vivian Albuquerque, a local lawyer who I spoke to about, largely about the student work visa announcement that came last week. Some of her points are they tie into just sort of this slew of announcements we've been having lately. She's not too happy with the proponent of the federal immigration minister by the sound of it. And I found her perspective very interesting as a former international student herself.
Yeah, a lot of great insights too. So I guess it's almost time to wrap up our news roundup. But I wanted to ask you what is coming down the pike for you.
For me, I am working on a story about rent increase workshops that are going on in DG because it is housing season, eviction season, rent increase season. The city of Montreal also this week has made some announcements, released some resources to make sure that tenants really know their rights before they sign on to agree. Actually, come to think of it, I haven't got my rent increased yet. I usually get one every year. What about you, Cam?
Yeah, I usually get one every year, but my I'm in a pretty good situation, so I can
Yeah, ours is usually reasonable. Last time they asked me for $30, and we you know, looked up how we can say no. And yeah, for those especially in the Concordia community, maybe who are new to Montreal. That might be a good one to tune into because it's very different here with the way Quebec breaks down exactly how much a landlord is allowed to ask. It's not a flat percent. It's a little bit confusing. And people need to know their rights to their landlords, not just tell them, you know.
Yeah.
Like when my landlord asked me for $30 increases, we worked it down to 20. 20 was 20 was fair. Yeah. So, I'm looking forward to that. There is more coming down the pipe for Black History Month. What else do we have on the go these days? I am eagerly anticipating. I believe there's a couple unions left to vote on the deals. Talking about since November, the deal is over the last couple weeks. For public sector workers, there have been not a small number of smaller unions said no, especially in terms of things like working conditions. The pay issue is a little better. People are very happy to get that inflation clause added. But some teaching unions are saying, no, it's about more than that. It's about the conditions that our students learn in. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we got next.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting. You can catch us, once again, you can catch us here Thursdays, 9 a.m. every single week with a little news update about all the things we've been reporting on. And also, you can find these episodes available online. They're on the CJLO SoundCloud, so you can check them out there. And they're also under the CJLO News Spotify feed. So, check those out and keep it locked to CJLO, though.
Yep, and frequencynews.ca, my weekly plug, now that we've got a nice shiny website up over at the LJI, the Local Journalism Initiative. You'll find my reporting on there. And also a lot of good reporting from Quebec, from Eastern Canada, from across the country, and also other reporters in and around Montreal as well.
Yeah, it's definitely worth checking out because, you need this kind of news is really important when you want to think about.
Yeah, I think our stories this week really showed that. We really trickled down from, we went from federal cabinet all the way to Bienvenue NDG.
Yeah, it's really all-encompassing stuff.
Yep, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, bye for now.
Bye.
For generations, we've farmed the finest artisanal homegrown campus radio in the greater Montreal area, celebrating 150 years of CJLO 1690 AM. It's a family tradition.
Pansy, Annie. Bonjour, hello. This is composer Andrew Balfour inviting you to experience Ispichiwin, a musical journey bridging cultures and perspectives. It is both a personal journey and evocative testament to the transformative power of music. This recording features Calgary's luminous voices with the incredible Jessica McMahon and Walter McDonald Whitebear on flutes. It is my hope that this album deepens our understanding of Indigenous storytelling. Ispichiwin is available now wherever you listen to music.
This Justin.
REVC is no longer on Thursdays. It's Mondays at noon.
Mondays at noon.
Music so good you'll exterminate.
I know you set your eyes.
Did you know that you are residing in the fourth most sponge-like city in the world? That may sound like a dubious honor, but it's actually one of Montreal's most invaluable traits in the fight for urban climate change adaptation. But what exactly is a sponge city? A sponge city can absorb rainwater with natural infrastructure like parks, urban forests, and bodies of water, rather than relying on concrete to divert the rainwater away from the city. This is crucially important to mitigate the damage from flooding, as 44% of all climate change-influenced natural disasters are flood-related. Montreal is rated highly as a sponge city because of our large number of green spaces filled with trees, like Mont-Royal Park. Green areas covered in vegetation absorb heavy rainfall, minimizing runoff. These areas also provide natural habitats for animals and are valuable as recreation spaces as well. Big cities aren't just concrete jungles. They rely on the natural infrastructure of the earth just as much as man-made materials. So, how can we adapt? Currently, Brewster Park in Lachine is transitioning into a sponge park, a green space that is the first of potentially many across the city. These sponge parks are able to absorb large amounts of rainwater through water retention systems that divert rainfall from the city streets into the park, preventing sewers from flooding during extreme weather. Montreal may be one of the world's most naturally sponge-like cities, but that doesn't mean we can't still improve. Studies show that adapting more blue-green infrastructure, like sponge parks, is not only more efficient for water management, but also more cost-effective for cities that utilize them, instead of concrete storm drains. A climate change PSA, brought to you by CJLO 1690 AM.
I'm just sitting on a wall. I'm always trying to do it all. Really wanna get away to where I really couldn't say. I'm just sick of all this shit, and everyone is buying it. I'm just sitting on a wall. When I fall, I fall. Yeah, we got lucky, fell into place. We found some friends, some states, some passed away. And when we realize that our life is long, you already halfway gone. I'm just sitting on a wall. I'm always trying to do it all. Really wanna get away to where I really couldn't say. I'm just sick of all this shit and every.